Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's University, and I'm joined by my colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's associate director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. Past episodes of the podcasts are archived at iTunes and also at our own website, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about a controversial topic that has bedeviled American law and politics and culture for about 50 years now, and that is abortion. Abortion legislation has been back in the news once again and also back at the Supreme Court. In the last several months, a number of states have passed new abortion legislation in recent months, both very permissive legislation and also very restrictive legislation. And the court recently issued a per curiam opinion regarding one such piece of legislation from Indiana in a case called Box versus Planned Parenthood that we're going to discuss. Now, this new legislation is obviously a response on both sides to the new makeup of the Supreme Court. But the new legislation is also important, at least in part, as a result of things totally disconnected from the court. The new legislation is also the result of political developments at the grassroots level, at both sides of a partisan divide. So in our podcast today, we'll discuss the new activity in state legislatures regarding abortion and also explore how the court might treat this legislation based on existing Supreme Court precedent. And then we'll talk a little bit about what the great divide in state laws on abortion suggests about this particular political and cultural moment in our country. Because, at least in my opinion, these abortion laws are about more than just abortion itself, as important as that topic is. Okay, Mark, well, let's talk about this case, Box versus Planned Parenthood, which was decided just last month by the court.
Sure. So this case involves, as you say, two Indiana statutory provisions that were in front of the court. The first was involved prohibiting incineration of fetal remains together with infectious and pathological waste and permitting cremation under certain circumstances. And the other, more controversial provision, involved prohibiting the provision of race, sex, and disability selective abortion. So in this kind of under the radar and not so noticed, and I think this was intentional on the part of the court, summary reversal, the court reached the first question and did not reach the second question.
So unsigned opinion, right? Per curiam.
A per curiam opinion, very much under the radar. And we could talk a little bit about that and what that suggests. But the court only reaches the first question. It says, by summary reversal and per curiam, that the law governing disposal of fetal remains has a rational basis and therefore doesn't violate the lowest standard of review that the court applies to these kinds of questions. The court says that nobody argued that the law imposed an undue burden, and we'll talk about that standard, but that's the standard that the court uses for abortion, many abortion cases. But it says Planned Parenthood, which had actually won in the Seventh Circuit, assumed that the law didn't implicate a fundamental right. That is to say that this disposal law didn't implicate a fundamental right. And the court said the state has a legitimate interest in the proper disposal of fetal remains. So it kind of reaffirmed this very deferential standard of review, unlike, by the way, in some recent examples of rational basis scrutiny.
Sure, sure. But there was also another part of the Indiana law which prohibited race, sex, and disability selective abortions. What happened with that part of the
law? Yeah, so the court denied cert on that second statutory provision. It said, we're not really ready to weigh in on that. We'd like more circuit courts to express their opinion. And interestingly enough, you have some disagreement among the justices, but a large number, especially the new justices, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, they don't say anything about this issue. They're just silently part of the per curiam.
Right. And for some of our listeners who may not be lawyers, denying cert in a case is not a ruling on the merits.
Correct. It just leaves, it leaves the Seventh Circuit opinion intact. The Seventh Circuit opinion struck down that requirement. So a couple of interesting things to note with respect to internal court dynamics. Justice Sotomayor actually had voted to deny cert on both questions, so she wouldn't have touched the disposal issue either. Justice Thomas wrote a very long concurrence detailing the history of abortion as a tool of eugenics. Mm-hmm. And I think that while he ultimately concurred with the court in denying cert on that question, I think that was a very strong indication about where he stood. Justice Ginsburg dissented and concurred in part, basically arguing that the court should have evaluated the first issue under an undue burden standard and affirmed the Seventh Circuit, and actually some quite pointed remarks in response to Justice Thomas. So it was interesting to see those kinds of dynamics in play.
Right, although that's just between Justices Ginsburg and Thomas, right, Mark? The other justices had a studied silence on these issues.
Absolutely right. Yeah. And I think that's quite suggestive in light of some of the other things that we're going to talk about, but the court was unwilling to most members of the court to show their cards with respect to this question.
Okay, so the court, I think it's fair to say, ducked the real important question with regard to abortion regulation in the Box case.
And I think it's suggestive of the courts being hyper aware of the controversial quality of these cases, to say the least, to understate it.
Right. Well, okay, and Box is not going to be the end because, as we said at the start of the podcast, the case comes in the context of several other pieces of legislation from other states that are either very permissive with respect to abortion or very restrictive with respect to abortion. And we're seeing a real divide among the states on this question. So, Mark, let's talk a little bit first about the restrictive abortion statutes in states like Louisiana and Alabama and Missouri.
Good, good. So in fact, I think you're exactly right. We're seeing a kind of new polarization that we haven't seen before. And one side of the polarized spectrum is in these much more restrictive laws that are being passed. So Louisiana has a law that prohibits the abortion of an unborn human being with a detectable heartbeat, the so-called fetal heartbeat legislation.
Right. And we should note for our listeners that a fetal heartbeat, in terms of contemporary science, a fetal heartbeat can be detected as early as 6 weeks, which would be well before the point of viability under current standards, which would be around 24 to 28 weeks, which is why, rightly or wrongly, opponents see these fetal heartbeat laws as a frontal attack on Roe and Casey. And we'll explain that a little bit later in the podcast.
That's right. And just a couple of other features of the Louisiana law: no exceptions for rape or incest. That has always been an extremely another very, very controversial feature of state laws regulating abortion. There are exceptions for danger to the mother's life or serious risk of impairment of a vital bodily organ. And then there are other states. Louisiana is not alone. Other states with similar fetal heartbeat laws: Ohio, Kentucky, Georgia, Mississippi, South Carolina. Some of these laws have been enjoined already by federal district court judges in these states, the Mississippi law, for example, the Kentucky law. But those are some of these, that's just a sort of an overview of some of these fetal heartbeat laws.
Good. Okay. Now, Alabama has a slightly different law, right?
Yeah. Alabama's is more restrictive. In fact, it's considered to be the most restrictive. It prohibits abortion in all cases except where necessary to save the mother's life or where there is a fatal abnormality in the fetus. So no exceptions for rape and incest. Doctors who perform abortions under the new law face up to 99 years in prison. Women who have abortions do not face prison time. President Trump, who is, I mean, I suppose his views are unclear with respect to some of these social questions, but some of his, at least his administration's views tend to come down on the side of supporting at least some of these kinds of laws. Well, he came out against the Alabama law saying that he is, quote unquote, strongly pro-life, but that he supports exceptions for rape and incest. So that's really, I think, on the very furthest side of this political spectrum of these laws.
Okay, and then we have Missouri, which has passed a law that bans abortion after 8 weeks of pregnancy without any exceptions for rape or incest.
Right, so this is, again, you could call it part of the fetal heartbeat suite of laws, except that rather than stating that the state is looking for the moment that the heartbeat can be detected, the state of Missouri just made a kind of cutoff at 8 weeks.
Right, which would still be before viability.
Which
well
would still be
well before.
And it's a little bit more moderate in the sense that there are exceptions for medical emergencies in mm-hmm. this law. At least the legislators, I understand what you said earlier about this being perceived as a frontal challenge to Roe and to Casey. But from the legislator's point of view, from what I've been able to find, this was not intended as a frontal challenge to Casey. And we'll talk about why that might be, given the nature of the standard. They wanted to, so they say, get as close to the line as they could without presenting a frontal challenge to Casey. Of course, you are right that 8 weeks to prohibit outright abortion before viability is going to be seen by most people as a frontal challenge, but it's unclear exactly what constitutes a frontal challenge under the pre-viability standard that we've got.
Yeah, it would seem like a frontal challenge to me, but we can talk more about that. Now, that's one side. These are states that have passed very restrictive abortion legislation, but there are other states which have been passing extremely permissive abortion legislation. You might view these states as acting, at least in part, in response to the first set of states. And one of the states is Illinois.
Yeah, right. So, and I think you're right. Part of this is a response to the kind of grassroots politics going on in some of these other states. Part of it is a response to, again, perceived threats by the Supreme Court as presently constituted to Roe versus Wade or Planned Parenthood versus Casey. We'll get into that in a little bit. But at any rate, Illinois just passed a law that was just signed by the governor protecting the right of a woman in Illinois to get an abortion at any time during her pregnancy and stating that, quote, a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus does not have independent rights. So this is a very strong stand that it doesn't matter when you want to have an abortion, you can have it at any time. New York is another state.
Right, that's our own state. Well, so New York just in January passed a law that protects abortion rights at any time if the mother's health is at risk. And this is a change because the previous law in New York State only permitted abortions after 24 weeks if the mother's life was at risk. So this is a big change. Again, in some ways, this was a direct response to the perceived threat that Roe and the Casey regime is now in danger with a new composition of the Supreme Court. It was passed with great fanfare here in New York. The state government lit up the World Trade Center, or the Freedom Tower, I guess, now downtown in pink to celebrate this passage of this legislation.
And if you remember, Mark, some legislators were taken to task for this, but they made statements, they made arguments that the right to abort or kill the child should be maintained even at some unclear moment after the child had
been although born. That's not part of the statute.
That's not part of the statute, but that was part of the political climate in which we were operating, right? That was state legislators actually said these things, which was quite extraordinary, I think.
Okay, so that's New York and Illinois. And then there's also California, Washington, and Oregon have also recently expanded their abortion laws in light of the perceived threat from the new Supreme Court. Okay, so that's what's going on here. Obviously, a lot of activity in the state legislatures, both restricting and permitting abortions in light of what may happen at the Supreme Court. So let's now talk a little bit about the existing state of the law. And the existing state of the law is called the Roe and Casey regime. I mean, actually, Casey is the more important case at this point, Planned Parenthood versus Casey from 1992. The important opinion here is a plurality opinion by Justices O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, which affirmed the core holding of Roe versus Wade, saying that abortion is a constitutional right, but changed the regime some. So under Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the key question is not the trimester system that was the case under Roe versus Wade, but rather viability. So before the point of viability.
And viability is, Mark, what?
Well, viability, Mark, is defined as the point at which the fetus would be able to survive outside the mother. According to current scientific knowledge, that is 24 to 26 weeks into pregnancy.
Right.
So before viability, then abortion can be limited as long as the limitation is not a, quote, undue burden. So states may not impose an undue burden on the woman's right to obtain an abortion before the point of viability.
And of course, you've got this quote in Casey when the court is trying to explain what an undue burden is. The court said, quote, a finding of an undue burden is a shorthand for the conclusion that a state regulation imposes a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus, right? So an undue burden is a substantial burden or an undue obstacle.
Yeah,
right.
An undue burden is a substantial obstacle, so that's not exactly crystal clear, but that's the standard that we have. Now, post-viability, again, post 24 to 26 weeks into pregnancy, a state may restrict and perhaps even prohibit abortion, provided that the state makes exceptions for the life and the health of the mother Health, like undue and substantial, is a term that is never really defined in the opinion.
And often dependent upon, for example, what doctors believe is in the health interest, is in the interest for the best health of the mother. So on that score, you know, state interest and potential life of the fetus are triggered, said the court in Casey, at conception. This is why it makes it a little bit strange to say that the core part of Roe was upheld. It really wasn't upheld because that's not at all what Roe said, but that's what the court said it was doing. So under the sort of practical result of all of this in Casey was that a series of requirements under the Pennsylvania law at issue were upheld and one was not. So 24-hour waiting requirement was held to not be an undue burden. The reporting requirement, parental consent for minors, were not undue burdens. But spousal notification, the court said, was an undue burden. So you get this kind of very particularistic application of this general standard, which, of course, you can imagine is going to come out differently depending on the A, composition of the court that you've got, and B, the nature of the particular issue in front of you.
Right. And then we had a couple of other cases, not that many cases at the court. One is involving partial birth abortion called Gonzalez versus Carhart, in which the court held that a prohibition on partial birth abortion was not an undue burden, even though the law at issue did not have an exception for the health of the mother. And then there's a more recent case from a couple of years ago called Hellerstedt, Mark.
Yeah, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt from 2016. This case was decided 5-3. It was decided after Justice Scalia had passed away. And we should mention, you know, Justice Kennedy was very, very important for the resolution of these cases. He often held the swing vote in these cases. That was the case in Whole Woman's Health, where Justice Kennedy joined the liberals on the court. The opinion itself was authored by Justice Breyer, and the court held that Texas laws requiring abortion providers to have admitting privileges at local hospitals and that abortion facilities meet ambulatory care center standards, well, those were undue burdens on women's rights to an abortion.
Okay, so to give a kind of shorthand for the law under the Casey and Roe regime, it is pre-viability, the state cannot impose an undue burden on a woman's right to obtain an abortion. Post-viability, a state may restrict, maybe even prohibit abortion, as long as the state makes exceptions for the life and health of the mother. Okay, so with that as our standard to go by, Mark, let's think about these new laws that have just been passed, and let's talk about first the constitutional implications of these laws and then the broader social and cultural implications.
Okay, fine. So on the constitutional side of things, if we start with the laws removing restrictions on abortion,
the permissive legislation.
The permissive laws, the ones in Illinois or New York or California, the blue states, those are likely going to be constitutional under the Constitution. There's no basis for saying that a state cannot make abortion legal throughout pregnancy.
Right.
So at least under current doctrine, that's certainly the case.
And that's unlikely to change, I think, in the immediate future.
I would think so, too. I mean, there have been arguments that have been made that the fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment and so on.
But those are really fringe arguments.
Those are fringe. Certainly, rather than fringe, I would say arguments that certainly have not been accepted.
I'm speaking simply descriptively. They are fringe in American constitutional law.
I agree with that. Okay. I agree with that. And, you know, you could try to think about other possible arguments, other possible constitutional bases that the federal government could have for outlawing abortion, for saying that it violates some you know, the constitutional provision, the Commerce Clause, the spending power. I think that those are probably, at least for the moment, not on the wall of live possibilities.
Yeah, I think so. That's all I meant by fringe. I mean, I'm not dismissing the argument. I'm just saying it's just not really within the ballpark of doctrinal arguments, right?
I think that's right.
As the law exists today. Now, how about the laws that have been increasing the restrictions on abortion?
Okay, so this area is going to be less clear, it seems to me. Number one, because the court hasn't taken that many cases, abortion cases, since Casey. So there hasn't been a lot of fleshing out of the undue burden standard.
Or substantial obstacle standard.
Also, all three members of the Casey plurality are no longer on the court.
Yes. In fact, I think that Justice Thomas is the only justice who is still serving from the time of the Casey court.
Right. And he dissented
and
Casey. And I think given his comments in Box, it seems to me his views on the matter are fairly plain.
So, my guess is that at least some of these new restrictions would be unconstitutional under Casey, that is to say, they would be considered undue burdens, I think.
The way that I'd put it is they would certainly be undue burdens in the way that the undue burden has been interpreted, with Justice Kennedy as the fulcrum member of the court.
Right. That's a good point.
So the composition of the court is different today. However, at least insofar as we evaluate the undue burden standard in light of cases like Stenberg and Gonzalez versus Carhart and Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, set aside the Alabama law, right? Mm-hmm. But even the fetal heartbeat laws, if you're banning abortion altogether pre-viability, it seems like that's an undue burden on the woman's right to obtain an abortion. Again, at least as that standard has been interpreted thus far.
I think I agree with that, Mark. And I would only add, as we've said, though, that, you know, Justice Kennedy's not there anymore. And of course, everyone is expecting that the new justices on the court may well have a different approach to undue burden than he had, which is why, actually, to get back to Box, it's sort of interesting how they really all kept silent on this issue, didn't want to say very much at the moment.
I think that's right. Not a peep from Justice Gorsuch or Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and the Chief Justice all dissented from Whole Woman's Health, which is the most recent of the abortion mm-hmm. cases, this Texas admitting privileges requirement case. But if you look at the dissents in those cases, you have a dissent by in Whole Woman's Health, you have a dissent by Justice Thomas that is much broader than the other dissent, but he's alone in that dissent. You have a dissent by Justice Alito, part of which concerns completely unrelated issues of res judicata, but when it does get to the merits, it's much narrower. It argues for the regulations at issue in that case surviving the undue burden standard. And that's the one that gets the chief to join, right? So that it's that dissent that gets the most numbers of people, including Justice Thomas.
Yeah. Well, so look, we'll have to see what comes from this. I mean, it's just sort of unclear at the moment what will happen, which I think explains some of this legislation. But I want to talk just a little bit about another explanation for this legislation, because it doesn't relate only to the court. I think that the new abortion laws that we see, the extreme division in the types of laws that we see, they're sort of a puzzle given current public opinion, and they require an explanation. You know, Americans consistently express divided opinions on abortion. According to the Pew Research Service last month, 58% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or in most cases. But if you ask the question differently, or you change the frame of reference, you see that 58% figure is a little misleading. For example, in a 2018 Gallup poll, 50% of Americans said abortion should be legal, quote, only under certain circumstances. Well, that gives a somewhat different impression. And if you break that down further by point of pregnancy or reason for abortion, then there's a different picture still. So 60% say abortion should be legal in the first 12 weeks, but only 28% say abortion should be legal in the second 12 weeks of pregnancy. 80% say abortion should be legal if the woman's life is endangered, but only 32% say abortion should be legal if the woman desires it for any reason at all. So, speaking purely in political terms, America's somewhere in the middle, which makes these laws sort of strange, both the extremely permissive abortion laws in places like New York and Illinois, and the extremely restrictive abortion laws in places like Alabama and Louisiana. So what explains this? Why do we see these extreme laws on both sides that don't reflect the consensus in America? These are laws that arguably expand access to abortion beyond what most people would want on the one side, or arguably restrict it beyond what most people would want on the other. And it seems to me that these laws reflect a deepening political and cultural polarization in America. Now, of course, there are different states with different political cultures, although I think even within these states, opinion is sort of divided. But they reflect a deepening division on cultural issues more broadly. And what I think about, I have to think about this some more, Mark, but what I'm thinking is that these laws, in a way, are meant to signal identity, the political identity of the leadership in these states. And so, in an important way, they're symbolic, and they're meant to see how the political leaders see themselves. In other words, we're the sort of community here, the sort of people that respect women's rights and will allow abortion for any reason at all, not like those retrograde other states. Or alternatively, we're the sort of people who care about life and won't allow abortion under any circumstances, not like those zealots in other states.
Yeah, this may be a strong explanation. And I should probably emphasize, and I think I speak for you too, Mark, that, you know, when we do these podcasts, obviously, we address controversial issues. And abortion certainly is one of these. And abortion is an important issue all on its own, right? As a moral issue, yes. As a legal issue. But notwithstanding its sensitivity and its importance, it can also be analyzed and talked about sociologically, about what this tells us and shows us, the way that people feel about a particular issue like this tells us about the condition of American politics and American culture.
Yes, of course. So this analysis is not to say that abortion isn't inherently important. Of course it is. It's a very important issue. But it also is an important symbolic issue. It's meant in a way, I think this new legislation is meant in a way to identify in-groups and out-groups, and to say that certain groups are within the political discussion and certain groups are not. And so, we see that again and again in American politics.
How do you account then, Mark, for the geographic distribution of some of these laws? So, I mean, of course, you've got what looks like restrictive laws in the South and in some Midwestern states. Mm-hmm. And then you've got much more permissive laws on the coasts and in places like Illinois, which are kind of outliers as to the Midwest.
Well, because driven so much by Chicago.
Correct. So, right. So I mean, is that... How does that figure into the explanation that you're giving?
Well, that's another layer. It's just, we do seem to be on this issue. There seem to be significant regional differences. And, you know, we have, of course, seen significant political, cultural, regional differences before in America. Before the Civil War, you saw states passing legislation, not about abortion, of course, but about slavery that really were impossible in the end to reconcile. Now, I don't think we're at 1861 in America. That's not what I'm trying to say. But obviously, we are seeing some really deep cultural divisions, and I think this legislation reflects those divisions. And the last thing I'd say about this is, of course, it's ironic. In the Casey opinion, the court thought that the plurality opinion by Justices O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy was meant to put an end to this, was meant to call everyone, I forget the exact quote, but I thought it was to accept a common mandate rooted in the court's decisions. And obviously, that has not happened.
Yeah, no, I do think that in some ways these laws and the current problems, they're a real challenge to Justice Kennedy's variety of jurisprudence on this question. Justice Kennedy, Justice Souter, Justice O'Connor, they wanted in Casey to call the quote unquote thoughtful part of the nation, close quote, together to be tested by following the Supreme Court's resolution of this question. And that view of what the Supreme Court is all about is under real pressure, I think,
I agree with that. So let's end it there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. This has been another episode of Legal Spirits. Past episodes are archived at iTunes and on our website, lawandreligionforum.org. Look forward to next time.